Matthew Desmond is a Harvard sociologist and a MacArthur Genius Award winner, and he's just come out with a book called Evicted. To write it, he spent more than a year living in some of the poorest neighborhoods in Milwaukee. He says evictions lock entire families in an endless cycle of poverty. And as he told Steve Paulson, that used to be rare.
You know, when you read about eviction scenes in the 1930s and 1940s, they're weird. You know, they're scandalous. They're rare. You know, they draw crowds. People confront the marshals. They sit on furniture. They move people back in. They refuse to accept this scene of forcing a family out of their home. But today, you know, evictions have become, frankly, commonplace.
How common are they?
Every day in the city of Milwaukee, about 40 people are evicted from their homes. They're evicted in the summer. They're evicted in the winter. They're evicted all year round. It's an astonishing number, but that only counts formal court-ordered evictions that we can see by looking at legal records. But there are other ways to move a family out. So I've met landlords that will pay a family to move. I've met landlords that will take your door off. And so we designed a survey to look and capture these, what we call informal evictions. And we interviewed over 1,000 renters in the city of Milwaukee. And if you look at informal evictions that don't go through the court, you learn that about 1 in 8 renters in the city of Milwaukee are evicted every 2 years. That's an astonishing number.
Is this mainly hitting African Americans?
It is. I mean, if you spend any time in eviction court, you'll see that eviction affects the young and the old. It affects the able-bodied and the sick. It affects white folks, African American folks, immigrant communities. But it's absolutely having a disproportionate effect on low-income African American communities. And especially within those communities, women and moms with kids. You know, the face of America's eviction epidemic is mothers with children. Most households evicted in Milwaukee have children living with them. We asked renters, have you ever been evicted in your life? About 1 in 5 Black women in Milwaukee who are renters say that yes, 1 in 5. The comparison is 1 in 15 for white women renters. And so I've come to think of eviction as kind of the feminine equivalent of incarceration. You know, if we see in low-income African-American communities so many men being swept up by the criminal justice system and locked up, we're seeing so many women in those communities locked out, you know, affected by eviction, and they're bearing the costs and ramifications of it. But this is also a problem that's spreading and growing. You know, today, national statistics show that about 1 in 5 of all renters are paying at least 50% of their income on housing. So this is a problem that's affecting a lot of communities.
I mean, what you're saying basically is they don't have money to do the rest of their lives. I mean, for food and clothing and all of that stuff. I mean, so much money is going into just paying the rent.
That's exactly right. And we've reached a point in America today where most low-income families are paying at least 50% of their income on housing costs, and 1 in 4 are paying over 70% of their income just on rent and to keep the lights on.
70%?
70%. And, you know, we as a country long ago decided that 30% of your income is what people should spend on housing. 30% gives you enough money left over for food and transportation, to invest in your children, to buy some clothes now and again. But when you're giving so much of your income on housing, eviction becomes much more of an inevitability than the result of some irresponsibility.
Now, to do this study, you you lived in Milwaukee for a while. You lived in a rooming house in a Black neighborhood on Milwaukee's north side, and then you also lived in a white trailer park on the south side. Did you see a lot of differences? I mean, were there racial discrepancies there?
What I saw was the difference between white individuals getting evicted and Black individuals getting evicted had to do with the time spent trying to find new housing. You know, so I'm thinking of a woman I met named Arlene, and she was a single mom. She had 2 boys. When we met, she was spending 88% of her income just on rent.
So she had no money left for anything else.
No money left for anything else. And after one eviction, she moved to a shelter and she started looking for housing. And she looked at 20 and then 40 and then 60 and then 80 places. You know, I counted, you know, and a lot of folks had said no.
Wait, and so she went and looked at these places and they wouldn't rent to her?
They wouldn't rent to her. And one of the reasons, besides her poverty, also had to do with her children. So some landlords just said, you know, we don't want your kids, ma'am. There's something else that prevented her from finding more housing, which is her eviction record. So evictions that go through the court come with a record, just like a criminal record does. and they follow you around and they have consequences on your life just like a criminal record does. And so many landlords just refuse to rent to anyone with a recent eviction record. And that's why we know and we see this not only on the ground level in families' lives, but also in statistics, that evicted families move from poor neighborhoods to even worse neighborhoods. They move from not great housing to even more shoddier housing. And the reason for that is because they're kind of being pushed into the bottom of the market because of their eviction record.
And how does race figure into this?
So back to Arlene's story, I never saw white families spend so much time looking for housing. And one of the reasons was, you know, racial discrimination in the housing market is still real. And I can list off, you know, study after study that reaffirms this, but maybe I should just tell you a story. Mm-hmm. So I was spending time with two young African-American women, Crystal and Vanetta, and they met at a homeless shelter and decided to kind of throw their lot in together, pull their money to pay rent. And they went to look for apartments on the near south side of the city of Milwaukee, which is predominantly Latino. And they went into one apartment, and I stayed back in the car. I was watching Vanetta's kids. And the apartment was small, pretty shoddy, and didn't have a bath. And so she asked the landlord, you know, do you have another place? Is it, you know, anything with a bath? And the landlord kind of reflexively said, yes, I have a bigger place close. It's the same rent. It has a bath, a bit nicer. And then he suddenly stopped himself and pretended to answer his phone, had a fake conversation, and then hung up and said, you know, wouldn't you know it? You know, just rented it. And the women came back out. Vanetta was just shaking with shame. And so I took down that landlord's number, and I called him up the next day, and I went and toured that place, and I told him that I made the same income as Crystal and Vanetta had. I told him that I had three kids, just like Vanetta did. And I said, you know, you have anything with a bath? And they said, absolutely. And he drove me to the place and showed it to me.
Now, you also got to know landlords.
Yep.
As well as the renters who kept getting evicted. Tell me about them. I mean, did you get to know landlords well?
Very well. You know, I decided that if you were getting evicted, I needed to get just as close with your landlord as with you. I tried to kind of capture landlords' perspectives.
Well, let me ask you about one landlord you write about, Sharina.
Right.
Is that her name? So my reading of the book, I mean, she basically is a slum landlord. I mean, she keeps a lot of houses in, they're often in terrible shape. I mean, sometimes not a functioning toilet or refrigerator even, you know, roaches all over the place. Does she justify how she keeps these houses in such bad shape?
So I never call Sharina a slum landlord. I feel that my job is to document things as closely and accurately as possible, and you can use the label that you see fit. Sharina would say that she was offering low-income tenants who didn't have a lot of options housing. And for that deal, she cut some corners. Now, there are laws that prevent that. There are laws that try to make sure that people have access to decent and safe housing and give them rights. But I think it's important to recognize that those rights, kind of in a literal way, cost money. Let me just explain what I mean. So the Hinkston family is a family I write about in the book, and Shereen is their landlord. And they were a family that were jammed into this little tiny two-bedroom apartment, eight people living in there. It was tough. And there are folks living there that shouldn't have been. And that house slowly started to wear and tear. The plumbing got stopped up over and over again. Doors came off the hinges. Windows were broken. It was in a bad shape. And Doreen and her oldest daughter, Patrice, talked about calling the building inspector, reporting Sharina. But they knew that Sharina would probably evict them if they made that call. Retaliatory evictions like that are illegal, but you can evict someone at any time for violating the terms of the lease, like if you're behind in rent or if you have unauthorized boarders. And so those laws and those protections, they don't reach to the very bottom. They don't extend to people like Arlene, who someday will have to ask her landlord's compassion. And they don't extend to people like the Hinkstons that are trying to make ends meet by doubling up.
So you're saying that there are these kind of informal arrangements between landlord and renter. So it's not necessarily paying the sticker price, but in return, you don't get a fully functioning house.
You can trade the health of your kids, your human dignity, your tolerance for living with lead and exposed wires and no heat, you can trade that for a roof over your head. And the sad situation is that a lot of low-income families are facing exactly that predicament.
What was it like for you to see this? I mean, to see these people who were often just thrown out on the street and, you know, with all their possessions.
I've seen dozens and dozens of evictions. I've seen an eviction where we went into the house and it was just kids. It was just kids. The mom had died. And the kids had just gone on living and it was raining. The sheriffs moved the kids out, moved their stuff out, closed the door, moved on to the next eviction. That had a big effect on me. You know, it left me heartbroken, it left me depressed. I mean, this cold denial of basic needs had a deep personal effect on me. But I saw a lot of brilliance and a lot of spunk and a lot of spirit in the face of adversity. I heard laughter, you know, I heard jokes. And I think that the book chronicles these moments. And those moments just reminded me how gracefully people refuse to be reduced to their hardships and how poverty is just reducing people born for better things. All this suffering and poverty is shameful and unnecessary. Because it's unnecessary, there's hope. But I do think that, you know, this level of inequality, this depth of poverty, this doesn't align with any American value. This can't be justified by any piece of scripture or holy teaching. There's nothing that we can latch onto, I believe, no moral code, that can justify what we've allowed our nation to become.
Harvard sociologist Matthew Desmond, talking with Steve Paulson. Desmond is the author of Evicted: Poverty and Profit in the American City.